Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's King Day meets Inauguration Day, a Brian Lehrer Show special this morning, as we're listening to excerpts from our Martin Luther King Day event at the Brooklyn Museum from yesterday afternoon, the Obama pre-inaugural events at the Lincoln Memorial yesterday, and more. Let's go back to our King Day event. I hosted this with Adora Udoji from The Takeaway, and the clip that we're going to hear begins with Adora following up with Columbia Law professor Patricia Williams. Patricia Williams had just commented that she's distressed to hear people call this a post-racial moment. And the other panelists here, the writer John McWhorter and the historian Jelani Cobb. But Adora following up on Patricia Williams saying she's distressed to hear people call this a post-racial moment.
Whenever I see this in print about post-racial, are we living in a post-racial country? I have yet to hear a single black person or person of color broach that question, but I see it written fairly often by many white writers, thinkers, policymakers. What is post-racial to you, and what's your thought on what it means?
Frankly, I think it's something that sells magazines and newspapers. usually, the way I'm seeing that question put is that there's a question, and I think the tilt is usually the idea that, of course, we're not going to be a post-racial society, because we all know that things don't change that fast. But and we all know that there will still be racism and injustice. But it depends on what you mean, because I think that there's an issue of degree. I worry when we talk about racism, and I think that that's supposed to be the more interesting aspect of raciality, that there's a tendency to think of it in terms of binarity. And so if there's any racism, then we still have to sound the alarm with the same fervent agitation that we justifiably did in 1968 or 78. And the way I feel is that there comes a point when the question is not whether we're post-racial or whether there's racism, it's how much. And in terms of solving problems and teaching people how to get and to keep jobs and getting people better education, there comes a point when I firmly believe that racism and talking about it isn't helping anyone anymore. And so are we going to be a post-racial society? No. Is racism something to be stamped out when it comes up? Of course. But I sometimes sense that there's an excitement that comes up whenever the term racism is used, that it sells magazines, no offense whatsoever, but that one might have a forum about it or something like that, when really, really what should
be... Would you be speaking about DOS at WNYC?
No, not remotely, but I think that it would be much more valuable to people who need help if we were just as excited about talking about activism, new strategies for helping people, et cetera. So post-racial, of course not, but it's not an utterly worthless issue. The issue is how much racism.
John Lonnie, in terms of addressing some of the real issues that exist, I mean, I guess we can put any label you want to on it, you know, racism, discriminatory biases, particularly throughout all kinds of systems in this country. Who is in the best position? Barack Obama's got a huge amount of issues on his table, but where does that leave the rest of the leadership who would address some of those questions for, say, the African-American community?
Well, can I just say one quick thing about the post-racial point and then kind of work into this? One of the things I found most troubling about that is the fact that it's a very ahistorical discussion. When people bring up the idea of being post-racial, I generally point out that African Americans have been attempting to be post-racial since 1619. and when we talk about this moment in those terms, you know, it reminds me of what Frederick Douglass said at the end of the Civil War, when people were saying that they were basically dissolving the old abolitionist organizations. And Frederick Douglass said very specifically, no, we have to wait. You know, slavery is dead, but we have to hold our organizations to see what form, what new form this old snake may take.
Historian William Jelani Cobb, then later in the program, an audience member brought this point up again.
I was curious if we could ever have a society that is considered post-racial. And if we cannot, then why do we use terms such as progress, which imply a goal or an end?
Who wants to take that one on?
I'm not sure that being post-racial is a necessary goal. I don't need not to be black anymore. That's not a need I have. And I don't need people to not be who they are. These are not just, it's not just the color of my skin, but the culture and the heritage from which I come. And I don't need to pretend that that hasn't happened. Otherwise, we wouldn't all be sitting in here today celebrating this moment.
Left the house this morning. Bells ringing filled the air. I was wearing the cross of my calling. On wheels of fire, I come rolling down here.
Come on up for the rising. Come on up, lay your hands in mine. Come on up for the rising. Come on up for the rising tonight.
Bruce Springsteen and band singing The Rising from the album of the same name, the post 9/11 Springsteen work of art, one of the greatest artistic expressions, I think, of the emotion around the 9/11 attacks. Bruce Springsteen out at the Washington Mall at the Lincoln Memorial Concert in honor of Barack Obama yesterday. And WNYC culture reporter Siddhartha Mitter is in D.C. and joins me now. Hi, Siddhartha. Where are you right now?
Good morning, Brian. Happy Dr. King Day to you. I am actually not on the mall. I am at the place where I am staying, and I am trying to file some stories for the WNYC website.
Okay, so culturally speaking, what did you think of the Lincoln Memorial Concert yesterday? Did it signal a change from the Bush era just from the music?
I think that it was a very, very impressive concert, Brian. I think that the stagecraft and the organization was impeccable, clocked in just under 2 hours. It felt like it was moving pretty swiftly, except maybe when Tom Hanks gave his ring, which kind of went on for a while. The music was lovely. There were, in my view, there were, you know, a couple of duds and a couple that were maybe a little too obvious, but I thought the music was very, very well programmed. I thought that the pairings of musicians, the duos and trios that were put together especially for the occasion, were really quite interesting. I think that you guys maybe earlier in the program heard a little bit of Jon Bon Jovi and Betty LaVette doing
Yeah,
the
we played some of that. I was surprised how much I liked that.
Man, to me was, you know, this morning, that is the song that I remember. It's such a beautiful song, that Sam Cooke song. The original treatment is so haunting and so delicate, and so it's an easy, easy, easy song to mess up. And who knew that Jon Bon Jovi had in him?
Right?
I really loved that.
Who knew, indeed? Well, here's another song that is so well known that it's easy to miss up. We have a clip, and people will recognize the song, I'm sure, of Beyoncé.
Oh, beautiful, for spacious skies, for amber waves of rain, for purple mountain majesties, above the fruit.
Everybody's got to take a crack at that one sometime or another, right?
Absolutely. I think she did a lovely job. I mean, I think some people, you know, were worried about how Beyoncé was going to appear, how was she going to dress, was she going to be over the top. And she looked lovely. She was mature. She gave a beautiful performance. And using that as the finale with all of the other performers coming out behind her and the choir and so on, it was a gorgeous moment, really.
Do you, since you were out there at the concert, do you have the answer to all these questions that are still coming in about Reverend Gene Robinson, not carried on HBO. Some people are saying the mic cut out when he was giving his prayer. Some people are saying this was an HBO decision or an Obama decision. Do you have any of those answers?
Man, I got to tell you, I don't have the answers, because you know how it is sometimes in the press area. We're so close to the action that we don't really know what's going on in the jumbotrons and all of that. But I will tell you that when Reverend Robinson gave his invocation, it took a lot of us by surprise. It happened a little bit before 2:30, and suddenly, out of nowhere, they said, "Oh, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Episcopal Bishop, Reverend Robinson," and we all kind of scurried to pay attention because it came a little bit out of nowhere.
We did put a link to the YouTube version of the Reverend Robinson prayer that we took from to air it on the show this morning. If anybody wants to see it at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. So what's the energy like in the city, Siddhartha?
Well, the energy is really, really interesting. It's been growing. It's been growing slowly. I want to say it's been warming up over the past couple of days, but that would be the wrong choice of words, because it has been very, very, very cold in Washington, certainly cold by Washington standards. And so I think that actually has been a little bit of a damper of the energy over the weekend. You haven't had quite the degree of street festivity that maybe people wanted to deploy. At the same time, in indoor spaces, in the coffee shops, in the bars, on Metro, in the Union Station food court, you know, in areas all over the district, the energy has been absolutely growing. You see, of course, people from all over the country, people representing where they come from, track teams, whole families with specially made T-shirts that they're wearing for the occasion, almost like family reunion style. And you could feel the crowd at all people converging on the concert yesterday. The energy was big. I mean, it was a huge, huge, huge crowd. Looking back across from the Lincoln Memorial down to the Washington Monument was an exceptional sight to see so many people, hundreds of thousands of people. But the energy was mellow at the same time. It's busy, but a real pleasant, mellow feel to it is what I have felt so far.
Ruth in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with WNYC Siddhartha Mitter in Washington. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I just wanted to say that yesterday I was watching the Mall program on HBO
mm-hmm.
with three teenage girls. I'm African American and they are too.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to them, when I went on the March on Washington, I was standing there and I pointed to a spot on the TV screen of the Mall. And they said, "You are on the March on Washington? You heard Dr. King say, 'I have a dream'?" I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Wow." And then I thought, you know, tomorrow Obama's going to get he's going to give his speech, and it's just fabulous that my life, I was in my 20s then, and I'm in my mid-60s now, and that my life has spanned that period of time. I just wish my parents had seen it.
And I wish Martin Luther King had seen it. Siddhartha, go ahead.
Yeah, Ruth, if I can make a couple of points. I think you're absolutely right. It's very, very, very moving. And the children have been very present in Washington over the past few days. Children wearing their Obama shirts, children talking about Sasha and Malia and so on. You can really feel families and children very, very present here. And the other thing is that these historical memories that are only just a few decades old are omnipresent. I attended a church service yesterday morning, Sunday morning, at the All Souls Unitarian Church on 16th Street, which is one of the historic congregations in D.C., historic multiracial congregation in D.C. And it was really an exceptional moment to see this big crowd, half black, half white, joining in chorus for Lift Every Voice and Sing. There were tears everywhere. And I think that these images and feelings have been all over the district and probably in a lot of quarters in the country in the past few days.
Ruth, thank you so much for your call. We're going to close the loop in just a minute with your attendance at the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech, because we're going to conclude with an excerpt from that speech. WNYC Siddhartha Mitter, if you want to read more of his stuff, he's blogging at WNYC.org. All our reporters in D.C. are blogging at WNYC.org, so go check it out. And Siddhartha, we'll talk to you again tomorrow morning during the run-up to the inauguration.
Thank you, Brian. I look forward to it.
Have fun today. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. This has been our King Day Meets Inauguration Day special on The Brian Lehrer Show. Special thanks to producers Alex Goldmark, Cheryl Rogers, and Janaea Williams, who produced our King Day event at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. And let's go out with a couple of minutes of the I Have a Dream speech but not the part you always hear.
We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual.
Martin Luther King from the I Have a Dream speech. Not the usual feel-good part, a tougher part of that speech. And that's how we end King Day Meets Inauguration Day on The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC for today. Stay tuned for Leonard playing some of the gospel music that MLK might have been listening to back then. Have a great day.